Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, which is, of course, no doubt, very episodic. And it's done for the pleasure of the intelligence agents, who are, in fact, the only people who get paid to listen to the show. Everybody else doesn't have to pay, it's all free, but some people give anyway. And I do want to specifically give a call out to my donors, my listeners, my sponsors, and all of those people there who help to keep this show on the road by providing a bit of your hard-earned cash so that I don't have to go out and earn it. Instead, I can just stay here, work on it, and publish it out to you and everybody else for the benefit of the listening audience. Because I want people to understand, if you haven't been listening to the show for a very long time, if this is your first experience with the Vinnie Eastwood Show, understand something very, very vital. There are people of completely differing opinions from radically different fields at all times coming onto the show. When you listen to it, after a period of time, the way that you look at the world will change. Not because we gave you great information and so on and so forth. Yes, that's a part of it. But because we showed you things that you disagreed with. Things that were strange to you. Things that sounded completely insane. And as soon as you start listening to things that sound insane, you start to realize how sane you are by comparison. My very special guest, Joe Atwell, former Jesuit priest, ladies and gentlemen. I rest my case. So what have we got you on the show today, Joe? Because you sent me a video saying that this is what you're talking about nowadays, but I hadn't had the chance to view it.
Well, I mean... you know, I do quite a few shows. I talk about my Caesar's Messiah book a lot. That's still probably the thing that I most discuss, which has to do with the origins of Christianity and my take that basically it's, you know, the religion was created as government propaganda from the Roman Empire and that it basically was just a way to keep the people in line during the feudal system as the religion played out. And then I also, you know, I have a book on Shakespeare, which is just as my book on the Gospels is a kind of unique perspective. The Shakespeare book is also just, you know, it creates a whole new interpretive framework, a new author, just tries to explain and decode the literature. Now, what happened, as you well know, is that I've been asked to talk about neo-Christianity quite a lot. You know, the Course in Miracles. You know, like how because I have this, you know, kind of well-known theory on the origins of the original Christianity. What was my opinion on neo-Christianity? And when I studied it, because I had been looking at how Christianity had been used as basically a mind control device to keep slaves pacified during the feudal era. I studied modern Christianity and felt it was just a second iteration. And I noticed that the real the creators of the so-called neo-Christianity were Thetford and Schuckman, who were two psychologists. And they just seemed really unlikely to me to have been wanting to channel Jesus and start a whole new version of Christianity.
Unless, of course, you think of Jesus as a psychological scam that gets played on people to make them subservient to their masters and all passive and stuff. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Which would be my, you know, my normal skeptical position. But anyway, I looked at these guys and I was interested in that. They both were working for a CIA operation called MK Ultra during the time when they were doing this purported channeling of Jesus. And I'd never heard of this. And so I started studying MKUltra, and that sort of led to a new understanding of the counterculture. I felt that basically, you know, our government was a kind of organized secret society. It was something, the real power of it was something we didn't see, and that they had very sophisticated methods, far better than the stuff the Romans had, to basically... give us the impression to create kind of a false understanding of history so that we wouldn't really see how clear our slavery you know, had been set up.
It's rather difficult to manipulate people who know who they are and where they come from, isn't it?
Yes. Good point, Vinny. And this is why I'm not going to hammer this too hard, but this is why shows like yours are so important, is because since the oligarchs are obviously attempting to create a kind of technological slavery, and they're using mind control to do it, the first line of defense is an informed citizenry. If we are paranoid, if we are concerned, we are a lot, and we are skeptical, we're a lot more difficult to fool. And, you know, you were talking about when you did the introduction, I was interested in that because you were saying, well, you know, we're going to show you things which are sort of outside your comfort zone. You may think of them as insane, but believe me, you know, there's going to be this benefit intellectually to you after the fact. And
even really if it was actually insane, there's still benefit to listening, because then you've got the experience of listening to that crazy person and what they're about, you know.
Well, I mean, that sometimes can be a waste of time, but often it is not. And really, what I would describe what you do is you're just trying to implement the Socratic method. You know, basically, we have lost somehow the idea that skepticism and questioning are beneficial in their own right. In other words, you need to always be skeptical because you can produce, you know, improvements in thinking. You can produce clarification in your understanding of yourself. And so we should never be afraid of looking at new ideas and contradictory ideas and having our basic premise about ourselves and about our history challenged. If we are worried about it, or if there is a whole system of concern to keep us from doing that, engaging in the Socratic method, then that would be a pretty clear tip-off that, in fact, someone is manipulating us to keep us within a narrow area of understanding. And so one of the areas that I've really been looking at recently and trying to get more people to be worried about and doing analysis about is the origins of World War II, which I've been, the more I've looked into it, have realized and, you know, come to believe that was basically one group created anti-Semitism, they created Zionism, and they also created the Nazi Party. So that World War II and World War I, to some extent, same group, but World War II was really the masterpiece. They just moved people around the planet like chess pieces and created a combination. The thing that really surprised me in all this was that was historical Zionism, which I had always thought kind of began with Jewish people, with Herzl, you know, and Moses Hess, and the kind of, you know, that they were, the Zionists were relating it to the religion, the ancient Hebrew religion, and to Jewish ethnicity. But that wasn't true. Zionism actually came from elite British Freemason purportedly Gentile families. Palmerston, Salisbury, Churchill's ancestor, John Churchill. It was in the 1840s, and they, Palmerston came forward and he said, now is the time, 1842, you know, 40 years before Herzl and long before Moses Hess, we're talking about like the creation of Israel. So Palmerston said, you know, now is the time for the Jews to return to their homeland. Now is the time to create Israel. This is really an amazing idea because at this point, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire. It wasn't a British province. Palmerston purported to be, I believe, an Anglican and a Gentile. Why exactly would he have this idea about suddenly that this is the time for the Jews to return to Israel and recreate the Jewish homeland? Now, I think that this naturally falls somehow into Palmerston's background as a Freemason. Palmerston wasn't just an ordinary Freemason. He was one of the most important Freemasons in existence. He was the head Freemason in the Orient, which was one of the reasons why he was in control of the gunboats that went up the Yangtze and slaughtered the Chinese when they tried to resist British opium addiction. This was Palmerston. So this, of course, doesn't really strike me as the acts of a humanist, right? Getting back to the question as to why he's wanting to create Israel for the Jews. His behavior in the Orient was that of a nihilist, you know, and someone who was very murderous. Now, beyond this, Palmerston was also involved in the so-called Irish potato famine, which I think is better described as the Irish genocide. Palmerston was one of the largest landowners in Ireland and was involved in the British seizing and stealing of all of the Irish food with a deliberate intention of depopulation. The potato famine was then the cover narrative. It was given to us. But a number of Irish historians have done just a really good work. And I believe his name is Chris Fogarty, has a website which has just absolutely airtight documentation. I mean, you can even see the bill of lading that the boats, you know, used to actually document how much food they were stealing from Ireland. So the Irish were basically intentionally genocided, and Palmerston was one of the organizers of that. This is sort of a separate topic than what I want to get into right now. But the point is that Palmerston is not a humanist. He's an extreme nihilist. He is racist as imaginable. I mean, he was able to genocide Irish people by the millions. He was actually personally gunning down the Chinese that didn't want to, accept British opium addiction. Why would he do this? The third part of his sort of personality is that he created what's called the Palmerston Zoo. And that was a name created by, I forget who it was, but one of the prime ministers of a European country. And he was accusing Palmerston of running agents for the purpose of basically creating social unrest. This is what led to all of the nationalist revolutions. People like Manzini, these are all Masons that were basically attempting to destabilize Europe leading up to, you know, the end of the 19th century. And he said, you know, why are you doing this? You've created a zoo of agents that you're running these Freemason agents everywhere. So this is Palmerston's background. Now, in spite of it, he decides that he wants to, for some reason, create this homeland for the Jews. Now, this was completely cutting against the basic sociology of Jewish people in Europe at the moment.
What's interesting, though, is that in a reading of Freemasonry and a reading of the Jewish Kabbalah, they're virtually identical.
Ah, excellent. And a good point. And when you look at, of course, the rebuilding of the temple as somehow a focus of Freemasonry, you can see that this would be, you know, naturally where Palmerston's interest in the recreation of Israel would come from. It comes from some part of the theology and kind of worldview of Freemasonry. Obviously, this is, I mean, it's a secret society. You know, you can't really see into it because, you know, they have the lower levels where you have all of your friends who are Masons, and then in the higher level. But this deflects people from being able to see deep inside it.
If I may, the reason why that is because in order to obtain those highest levels, you have to be tapped on the shoulder and specifically asked to come in. You can't ask, you can't prove yourself, they will tap you. That means whoever is in the current control structure of that group is the one who will allow new initiates through, and only the ones that they deem worthy. I.e., if you've got no soul and you're willing to sell out everybody, including the entire human race, welcome!
Yeah, I mean, it's a secret society. It's hard to know what actually is sort of the theology of it. I'll make some conjectures about it as we go along, but certainly we don't know what is inside it. We just know that secrecy is typically needed when people are conducting evil. When you are, you know, going to do altruistic acts, you really can permit sunlight and openness of information to exist.
Yeah.
So,
well,
anyway.
If I may, the difference is people talk about secrecy, but they don't realize that that's completely different from privacy. It's perfectly fine to have your own privacy and that kind of thing, but when you're operating in layers of secrecy, don't snitch, don't tell on anybody, you can't reveal these secrets or you die, that kind of thing. Those are criminal fraternities. All right? And then they keep those rules specifically because loose lips sink ships.
Right. And there's a kind of a sort of a generic DNA, to use an expression, that exists not just into Freemasonry, but into other secret societies. The Skull and Bones, the Bohemian Grove here in the United States, those would be two. But even though they rebrand themselves, they somehow basically recreate the same structures, the same family connections. And what you have is, I think, another organization, but it's under the overall auspice. I think that, you have like Skull and Bones at Yale, which is very famous. I think that's just a specific brand of Freemasonry that has normalized Freemason controls, but it just takes in people from Yale in order to create its society.
In fact, I watched a video not too long ago from Truth Stream Media that went into the details of these sort of intersected organizations and things like that, and they determined that there's approximately 160 secret societies within the United States that are part of this ostensible control structure. And what's interesting is that they're stratified, so that from early childhood up until university and then outside of university into the real world, there's sections and different points of clubs and organizations and things like that, which are all interconnected with this overall network of control and occultism and Satanism, essentially. And what's funny about that is it suddenly explains why people from different bloodlines and that kind of thing wind up getting involved in these organizations, because they provide them unfair criminal advantages in the workplace, in the marketplace, and so on and so forth. And because they owe their allegiance to this organization, and because they know what will happen to them if they betray this organization, they not only become the most loyal members of the occult, but they also become capable of excusing any behavior that they make and be able to get away with it without even feeling guilt, because, hey, this is all I've known, this is all we're doing, and that kind of thing. It becomes so normalized that the very concept of betraying your family, right? It's like the CIA is a family, the mafia is a family, so are these occult circles, and you don't betray family. And that's essentially how they get them. That's how cults indoctrinate people, that we're indoctrinating you into the family of this and so on and so forth. It's to make that blood connection where there is no blood being connected.
Right. So in the little strand of history that I was describing, you have Palmerston beginning the process, which then... 20 years later, began to manifest itself as archaeologic digs in Israel. So in other words, the British high-level Freemasons joined with, oddly enough, the British royal family. And they had a series of archaeologic digs. The Duke of Kent, you had really high-level British nobility participating in this phenomena of archaeologic digs in Palestine. Now, the reason for this was that they wanted to look for artifacts of ancient Israel, because since they now had a pretty well-established meme of the recreation of Israel, they needed to actually show that Israel had in fact ever existed, because up to that point, there really wasn't a lot of hard archaeological evidence. So they had a series of digs trying to come up with some artifacts. The best known of these, the one that the Duke of Kent participated in, was run by a guy named Charles Warren. Charles Warren, he wrote a number of books on, you know, how important it was to reestablish Israel. Again, he's purportedly a Gentile. He's an enormous Freemason. At the end of his tenure as an archaeologist, he returned to London, where they made him the chief of police. And at that time, his best known activity was to oversee the Jack the Ripper investigation. He was the one who actually oversaw all of this. And as the evidence started to get into important people, Warren was criticized for basically grinding the whole thing to a stop. But in any case, that was his job during this time. Now, he also, more importantly for my little story, is he created a lodge, a Freemason lodge called Quattro Coronati, which in my opinion is the most important Freemason lodge and perhaps the most important organization in our history. It's not known. People are very few people know about it. It's still in existence, so I don't think it has much function any longer. It's just sort of titular to what it was in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. But it was called the Quattro Coronati, which means the four crowned ones. I think this has an occulted meaning. I think they're referencing the fourth king of Israel. Israel had three kings of undivided Judea, Solomon, David, and Joshua, after which the nation partitioned, and you had this everlasting strife leading up basically to the diaspora. So the idea of Quattro Coronati, I think it's just a conjecture that that's what they're referring to. But the Quattro Coronati basically was a research lodge and was involved in this effort to try to find basically a history for Israel. All right. Now, the Quattro Coronati also spawned. So the Quattro Coronati can be seen as the receptacle, basically, of this proto-Zionism. Individuals from the Quattro Coronati and the circle that it worked within then produced what can be called Jewish Zionism. Herzl was an agent, or can be easily seen as a cutout of this agency, of this organization, the Quattro Coronati. He had a nickname when he was in college, before he was even a Zionist, of Tancred, T-A-N-C-R-E-D. And this was the name of a character from a book by Disraeli. Disraeli was a novelist as well as a politician. And before he became prime minister, he had written these weird books about the reconquering of the Holy Land. One of them was Tancred. Tancred was a heroic character. Herzl adopted Disraeli's character as his code name. He was known as Tancred, sort of as both a nickname and then as a code name for the rest of his life. And it shows that he was related to this group, that the Quattro Coronati had individuals like Disraeli, Salisbury, Palmerston. These are the British elite politicians that were intent on putting Zionism into historical motion.
Are these, by chance, some of the people who collaborated with the Balfour Declaration?
This was the group that created the Balfour Declaration. I mean, the Balfour Declaration, more accurately, could be called the Cecil Declaration. Balfour was the Cecil. The Cecils were the politically powerful Freemason family that aligned back in the 18th century with the Churchill family to basically rule England. I mean, the Cecils had control of prime ministers for over like 100 years, basically. So the Balfour Declaration was, you know, can easily be seen as something that comes directly from the Quattro Coronati. The individuals may not be identified as lodge members, but it's just one circle of British Freemasons and politically powerful politicians merged with, interestingly enough, Jewish banking interests. You know, if you look at like the Rothschilds, for example, who the Balfour Declaration was created for, they were also involved. There was, you know, you have these different, like the Clivedon set, these different cliques of organizations that contained individuals coming from the Quattro Coronati and other British political classes, but they're all pretty well organized. It's easy to see them as a group.
A thought just occurred to me that the Trilateral Commission is London, Washington, D.C., and the Vatican. What if they were? What if the Quattro Coronati's idea was to install a fourth crown in that set, and being Israel?
Yeah, very interesting. It's hard to know. I mean, it's an occulted. Organization. You can only approach it analytically. You can't really, they're not going to give you, you know, hard documents. This would be amazing if we could find such, but we can certainly approach it analytically. We can understand, you know, what it was planning to do by what it did. You know, in hindsight, we can see these things. So, one thing that is, I think, completely clear, and I don't think historians would contest this, is that the era of Jewish Zionism sprang from Proto-Zionism. Proto-Zionism was a Freemason project. Palmerston and Charles Warren were certainly the two best known, but there was also the British royal family. And so you then had this whole strand of Jewish Zionism, which oddly enough had quite a bit of anti-Semitism created from it. Herzl was constantly pointing out that anti-Semitism was essential to what he wanted to accomplish. And to show what was going on, they wanted basically a reason for European Jews to emigrate to Israel. In Germany, in the last half of the 19th century, Jews were interbreeding with Germans, with Gentiles, at the rate of like over 40%. So you had basically very little specific Jewish identity that was really, you know, widespread among all of the Jews of Europe. This idea had kind of dissipated, and they were really sort of integrating into European, you know, kind of the different kinds of cultures that they found themselves in. There was a tremendous amount of it.
It was church in decline.
Absolutely. And so Herzl made the case that, you know, anti-Semitism was going to rise, and that it would be what would really animate European Jews to populate Israel. This is, you go through his diaries, and it's, well, first of all, Herzl strikes me as just being completely insane, but that's my opinion. But one thing for sure is he was a huge proponent and a creator of anti-Semitism. He would congratulate people who would have anti-Semitic remarks, saying this is correct. You know, the Gentiles and the Jews really shouldn't live together. There's always going to be this structural difference. This is correct. And we need a homeland. That's what's going to serve you as an anti-Semite. And that's what's going to serve us as historical Jews.
So he created the problem of Jewish persecution so that he could encourage the Jews who were being persecuted to go to a place where they could all be together and not be persecuted.
Right. So this is coming out of this you know, this strand of energy that is coming, creates the Quattro Coronati, develops Jewish Zionism, and then you start to have the eruption of anti-Semitism. Now, oddly enough, another group is being developed from the same organization, from the Quattro Coronati, and that is the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party is hard to trace back. It's really not, but it hasn't been done very often. People look at what's called the Tool Society, which was basically the legal organization that created the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party was like an LLC. It was like a corporation that was owned by the Tool Society. And now the Tool Society is basically simply a cutout. In other words, it's just an artificial structure that was created to create it makes it harder to trace the origins of Nazism back to the Quattro Coronati, but it's not too hard to do when you understand that the Tool Society had almost no original ideas. The Tool Society, the ideas were developed by the organization before the Tool Society that the Tool Society came from, and that is the Theosophy organization of Helen Blavatsky. Now, Helen Blavatsky was a member of the Quattro Coronati. She was given a Masonic diploma by John Yarker, and that's a name that people need to do more research into. He was known as the 77th member of the Quattro Coronati, 7-7. That was his designation. So you can see he's, because they have these little number special meaning, you can see he's a unique individual. He created the Masonic diploma of Helen Blavatsky, in which he calls her a brother. This is very unusual. I honestly can't find any other woman who had such a diploma. But Blavatsky was basically given this diploma, which of course would be then used as her basically bona fides to circulate through the Freemason world in Europe. But anyway,
like how New Zealand's players went to play in South Africa, they got called honorary blacks by the South African government so that they could go around everywhere without being segregated. Yeah,
there you go. I mean, when you know people, things get done. So the Quattro Coronati created basically what's called Memphis and Mizraim, which is an occult philosophy. It's unique to this lodge and to Yarker. So it's not supposedly inside mainstream Freemasonry. It's just a completely a crackpot, occulted philosophy. Blavatsky then uses it to create Theosophy. Now, one of her followers is Annie Besant. Okay, you may have heard of her. Her brother is one of the founders of Quattro Coronati. Besant becomes a follower of Blavatsky. Now, I just, because it's kind of a long lump, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I'm also hoping to stimulate some actual interest in people to do research into this, because I would love to see this become an area of more and more people to try to get to the bottom of it, because I'm pretty sure I'm right. I'm pretty sure you're going to see when you get to the end of all these connections that the same group created both of these strands. Anyway, so Blavatsky, first of all, she developed a thing called National Socialism. Where does National Socialism come from? It comes from a group of Americans called the Bellamys. They're cousins. They developed what we know as National Socialism. They developed the one-arm salute to the flag, right? The raised hand. National Socialism was just a kind of an attempt to focus patriotism and belief in the importance of a nation and being basically obedient to a nation. National Socialism. We can have a more powerful, better world if we all organize ourselves, become more patriotic. Worship the flag. I mean, the Pledge of Allegiance was developed by the Bellamy brothers. It wasn't something that comes from Nazism. It's actually developed in the United States at the end of the 19th century, and it comes from the Theosophy Society. Okay, so National Socialism, the one-arm salute, that's being developed by the Theosophy Society. The Bellamys go to Germany. And they began to promote this this philosophy in Germany. And this was like before the, still in the 1800s, 1890. Now, Blavatsky also creates the swastika, the Masonic swastika. Remember, the swastika, the right-angled 45-degree turned swastika, was a unique Freemason symbol. You can see Rudyard Kipling, Duke of Kent. This is in the 19th century. They had the image. Blavatsky makes it her personal, kind of iconographic representation.
Her logo.
Yeah, she's got this on all of her literature. She's got the right angled Masonic swastika. Now, importantly, Blavatsky also develops and this is why you can see now, you can start to see it, that the tool society, which didn't develop any of these ideas, starts to disappear, and you start seeing the relationship between Blavatsky and the Nazi Party more clearly. Blavatsky is the one who also developed the concept of the Aryan race. Now, the Aryan race had been known and comes from the Indus Valley purportedly, and it has been used as to generally describe Europeans, but never in any kind of specificity. The term had basically long been forgotten. Blavatsky wrote a book called The Secret Doctrine, and in there she talks about the Aryans as having kind of this metaphysical racial energy. This was real important to her. And moreover, she also talks about the Aryan as superior. This concept of the Aryan superiority, which then ends up in the Nazi Party, is directly created by Blavatsky. She is the person who not only brings back the Aryans as a term for Europeans, but also that they are superior. And in her book, The Secret Doctrine, she even talks about, you know, you just can't educate these races who are not Aryans to learn things, to be engineers. She actually has a negative racial stereotyping. Okay, so Blavatsky organizes those parts of the Nazi Party. It's transparent that she's the creator of them, because the Tool Society, which comes from a guy named Sabatendorf, he's actually a follower of Blavatsky. It's not, these are not original ideas to him. He's just creating an organization, basically. As I said, it's a cutout, something in between Blavatsky and the Nazi Party.
It seems that the common thread therein is eugenics.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, so you have Sabatendorf, with Theosophist, and he's just bringing Blavatsky's ideas in unifying them. And he's got National Socialism now. He's got the swastika. He's got the Aryan race. He's got the Aryan superiority. But now you have a problem in that, how will Hitler be funded? You know, how do you actually create, because the Tool Society is basically a couple hundred people. Well, this is where Montague Norman steps in. Montague Norman is the head of the Bank of England. He has been the head of the Bank of England for over 25 years. Okay, enormous Freemason. But moreover, he's also a follower of Blavatsky. See, the Theosophy Society is as if a brand, basically, where you can see the strands all coming together. So Montague Norman, he works with, in terms of the German side of it, he works with Schacht, who is the financial minister of Germany, and he arranges money to flow into the Nazi Party and into Germany in general, because I'll explain why in a second. But he is specifically involved in the funding of money, which ends up basically being used by the Nazis and by Hitler to come to power. Now, how does he do this, you know, through the Bank of England? Well, actually, what he does is he has a family banking company called Brown Brothers. This is owned by Montague Norman's family. That company is merged with Harriman, Averill Harriman's banking family, his investment banking. It becomes what's known as Brown Brothers Harriman. So Brown Brothers Harriman is a new company, which is in the United States, and it contains people like Prescott Bush. Okay, people talk about Prescott Bush having a direct relationship into the funding through IG Farben and into the Nazi Party. Well, that's correct, but it is coming through Montague Norman. He's the organizer. He's the one who had the original investment banking company. And he merges it with an American banking company, just in the same way that the Tool Society comes into existence, to make it more difficult to trace as to exactly how the money is coming in.
So it's now a shell company, essentially.
It's a shell company, right. And now, if you had talked about the kind of the interconnectedness of the secret societies. So Montague Norman is a Freemason. He's a theosophist. But Brown Brothers merges with Harriman Banking Company. If you look at Wikipedia of the original lineup of Brown Brothers Harrimans, they list the number of individuals who are Skull and Bones members. It's like the entire And it's like they got 20 guys list, like 12 of them are Skull and Bones and the rest are Masons. So you can see that, you know, we had talked about how that there's this some kind of communication between the secret societies. So this is an example of it where Skull and Bones and Mans becomes the people who are involved with Brown Brothers Harriman. And they are, you know, one of them is Prescott Bush. And then they then work to get money funded surreptitiously into Germany. This is also when the Federal Reserve comes into existence. They help with interest rates and all these things go well economically so that Hitler, as he takes over, has economic sunshine suddenly with which he can build a war machine, which, of course, is going to be used to destroy his people. But nevertheless, I mean, and the Germans are seeing Hitler in a positive light because suddenly the, you know, economy of the nation is going up. Now, anti-Semitism is also coming into more and more focus at this point. Remember, we had discussed the fact that it had been also set in motion by groups from the Quattro Coronati. Well, anti-Semitism really, it's been sort of forgotten to history, but in fact, one of the most powerful parts of its creation at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, was a thing called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, this was found in the 1880s, I believe, and then it was distributed by...
Later ruled to be some kind of a hoax?
Well, we'll get into that. But the person who found it was a woman named Jalinka. She's a Russian Freemason family, but she's also a Theosophist. She's a very close member of Helen Blavatsky. She's meeting with Blavatsky. There's no contestation. The documents are in existence. Jalinka is in the organization. She's meeting with Blavatsky. And then amazingly, she's the one who discovers it. The Tool Society then gets it into Russia after World War I during the chaotic period following the Bolshevik takeover, and that's where
allegedly the Russians killed more Jews than the Germans ever did. But
well, allegedly, you know, again, with the history is in a mist. I'd love to have all of this stuff fleshed out, but you know, you mentioned that it was discovered to be a forgery. Yeah, I mean, as I would see it, no one is more pro-Israel than the British royal family. I mean, they basically created Israel, right? If you look at Palmerston and the Duke of Kent and all these patricians working with Rothschild to basically create the Balfour Declaration, it's a very tidy package, not hard to understand.
Whilst at the same time creating its opposite, which is anti-Semitism. So if you have this learned elders of Zion, oh, the Jews are all involved in this conspiracy, they want to kill us all, wouldn't that make everybody hate Jews?
Yeah, well, but then they have to bring that to an end because once they have basically achieved the position on the chessboard they want, they are pro-Zionist, in fact, so they'll have to try.
And then they come out and they say, hey, those documents turned out to be a hoax. Well, one that we created, you know.
I bet you won't guess who the individual was who found the foundation document from which the protocols were developed to prove that they were a hoax.
You got me.
I'm sorry. I know as a trick question. It's a guy named Alan Dulles.
Oh, my God. The Dulles brothers.
Yeah, it just happened to be in a library, Vinny. I mean, I think it fell out of the rafters and landed on his desk.
I tripped, fell, landed on the learned elders of Zion.
I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. So Alan Dulles is the one who actually found the so-called foundation document that showed it. So it was the whole thing was absurd. But Jalinka was part of this organization that produces the Nazi Party. I mean, if you look at the elements, if you think of the right-angled swastika, the flag salute, the armed salute, the National Socialism, the funding for it, the anti-Semitism, the Aryan, superiority, 100% of these things are coming right out of the Quattro Coronati group with Helen Blavatsky and the people she's working with. I mean, Annie Besant's brother is one of the founding members along with Charles Warren. So there's another person who is now set into motion historically. And this guy casts a very long shadow. People are starting to see just how many elements that we're dealing with now he was involved with the origin of. But he, at the same time that Blavatsky gets set into motion by the Quattro Coronati, they created a Masonic passport for him as well. He was a guy named Aleister Crowley. So now you get the entire package. You can see, because you see the occultism is part of what then infests Germany. The Quattro Coronati brings back astrology. Astrology had almost been faded out in terms of anyone paying attention to it in Europe. They bring it back. They bring back the occultism. And the reason they do that is because Blavatsky constantly was talking about every few generations, the Aryans produce a kind of world leader, a religious figure. And if you look at Hitler's presentation, particularly, during his ascendancy, he always is talking about how we are standing before God. You see, he uses this expression over and over again. He's not a Christian, but he is a religious Aryan leader. He is the individual that Blavatsky had seen. And so occultism, which is just basically making people bamboozled intellectually so they can't think straight, occultism was part of it. That's why the Masons had developed Memphis and Mizraim. That's why they brought astrology back. That's why they created Aleister Crowley, so that you would then have, Order of the Golden Dawn and just all of these ISIS cults popping up all over the place. They're all involved in Germany. The Tool Society, it's just a bewildering lineup of crackpot, occultists. Almost all of them have some kind of weird connection back to Crowley, right? I'm sure he's basically developing it. And it just creates a kind of metaphysical background to fool the everyday German into not considering that Hitler is just a puppet. He's just being set into motion basically to create a structure. Now,
can I just elaborate on that? Because you see one person as the head of one organization. You think that's all that you need to understand. And so it's simple, right? But if there's actually a couple hundred people from maybe about 20 organizations that you also needed to know in order to understand who that one guy is and what that organization he is represents, the vast majority of people will have no chance of ever figuring out who that guy really is.
It really wasn't possible until the internet and, of course, your show. Once it came into existence, then mankind had sort of turned a corner. But slight exaggeration, but the fact
I don't think so. I reckon it's true enough.
Anyway, the thing is that without the internet, without that kind of virtual library, this kind of research just isn't possible. Because believe me, you're not going to get this in some kind of history course in a college. You have to basically dig through. I would recommend if people wanted to start doing research, the LaRouche scholars have a lot of this. I don't think they go far enough, but they certainly have a lot of, they can show you all about the Quattro Coronati and about its connection into Zionism, its connection into the occult. And they also talk a lot about the promotion of these individuals into what becomes the Nazi Party. And then there's another guy that I like a whole lot named Rex Curry. He tends to think of, the relationship between Theosophy and he sees the relationship between that organization and the Nazi Party, but he sees more that socialism is this boogeyman in back of all of this. I just look at a different sort of, structure to it. I think all of this is basically being organized. And I would go so far as to say the final piece of the chess combination these guys executed is, so they get Hitler positioned, and they also have Winston Churchill positioned. Now, this is a really unique moment in world history, because Hitler took the position of Gotterdam, that if the Germans lose, they deserve to perish as a people. that we are fighting for racial existence, and if we lose, we will simply cease to exist. Now, opposed to him at this moment in history is Winston Churchill. Churchill also believes in what he calls total war. Total war is just the absolute abandoning of any kind of moral backdrop for warfare, and it involves the extermination of civilians. Okay, so it's total war. I mean, obviously, Churchill is firebombing Dresden, Hamburg, they're carpet bombing civilians, they're just, and of course, Churchill is, okay, so you have a unique moment where you have two groups, both led by individuals that are genocidists, right? And now Hitler will keep the German people pinned in place, no surrender until they're exterminated. The other side, the Russian horde, will sweep in and destroy civilian populations. Then, Churchill will bomb the civilians. And then at the end of the war, Eisenhower will capture the soldiers, put them into concentration camps, and starve them to death, supposedly. I mean, numbers I've seen are well over a million. But in any case, this is not a real war. In my opinion, this is basically a, it was a population reducing maneuver. And I think that if you look at the Irish genocide that Palmerston helped organize, and again, I would cite Chris Fogarty's just airtight documentation. Believe me, anyone who goes to Chris's website and look at the documentation will have no doubt that we've been fed a bill of goods in terms of this potato problem. I mean, this has had nothing to do with the starvation and destruction of the Irish people. It was completely a British Masonic maneuver to starve them. And just to give you an example, Britain had up to 70% of its troops inside Ireland during this period because the people were trying to resist. I mean, just imagine this little tiny dot of an island, how large the British Empire is. They brought all of their battalions in just to keep the population in check while they starve them to death.
Mm.
So,
unfortunately, we've come to the end of this hour here. So, we'll be right back with hour number two very shortly, ladies and gentlemen. My guest is former Jesuit priest Joseph Atwell, and we do need your help, ladies and gentlemen. So, go to patreon.com/Vinnie Eastwood or thevinnieeastwoodshow.com to make a donation debate. And we'll be right back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, brought to you by you, the listeners. If you weren't being contributing, if you weren't, in the case of the New Zealand listeners, they use the Kiwi Bank, you know, and those automatic payments that are coming into the Kiwi Bank usually every morning in some ways, that helps us to get the groceries on a daily basis, that helps to pay the rent on a weekly basis. And a lot of the international listeners have been signing up through Patreon, and what that's doing every month is that's allowing us to pay off the power and the internet bill, and also maybe a week's rent here or there. So at the moment we're at about $420-something dollars a month on the Patreon, and we want to get that up to $500 a month so that we can afford to start doing a little bit even more work on here behind the scenes and introduce an additional live YouTube stream of the Vinnie Eastwood Show every week, in addition to the American Freedom Radio stream. So if you do want to help us reach that goal and expand the show a little bit, go to patreon.com/Vinnie Eastwood. The links are on the homepage of thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. Now, my very special guest, Joe Atwell, is here, and we've been talking about Ireland and how the British potato famine was in fact a theft of Irish foods and goodstuffs, and how approximately, what was it, 55% or something like that of the British soldiers at that time in history were stationed in Ireland because they were trying to resist. So we're just going to pick up right from there, Joe. What's next?
Well, it's important to know that this is in context. In other words, you can see kind of the general moral perspective of the British ruling class from a number of historical events. One of them is the Irish genocide. One is the, you know, the opium wars. And the other would be, you know, their basically their promotion of Blavatsky and then the creation of the Nazi Party. There is something morally wrong with this group. And when you look at the idea that the Churchills were involved with...
Would you say that if Churchill's involved with these guys, and I think maybe you put it a bit lightly, you say that there's something wrong morally with this group. I would say it's actually in the opposite direction, where there's nothing morally right about this group.
We couldn't agree more. I mean, basically, they're... It's. I have suggested and have asked that we start creating a DNA database, because I think that there is some hidden ethnic or family relationship that kind of goes through a lot of these secret societies. Maybe not through all of them, but boy, oh boy, I would sure like to see the relationship between the Bush family, the Churchills, and the Rothschilds, just to name three.
They're related by blood. And in fact, a 14-year-old girl did this as like a school project, tracing the genealogy back of all the previous presidents. And she did unlike what normal genealogy does, which is only trace back the fathers and the marriages to the fathers' bloodlines. But she did the mothers as well, and she turned up that all the U.S. presidents are related by blood.
Yeah, well, there it is, and so. I mean, democracy has been defeated because basically we get to vote for, we get to choose between two individuals that are both from the same group. And this group has a moral perspective, which basically includes genocide as an okay thing. And so we, the citizens, can expect some really rough times going forward because, you know, the technologic snooping state will become the technologic slave state. And I think that we really, the citizens need to accept this, learn about it, understand it, and make the needed corrections, which is to say rebellion of some kind immediately, because otherwise we're just creating our own slave state, which will lead to genocide, obviously. They'll reduce population. I mean, you know, when I realized that Churchill's total war was coming from the same group that had created a German leader that would refuse to surrender, that created this artificial concept of a racial extinction rather than accept defeat, it seemed very clear cut. I mean, I think just analytically, it's just the most plausible explanation of history that exists. All of the links that I've provided are correct. I'm hoping that, you know, if I'm wrong, I will admit it. But I am hoping to stimulate as much research as possible by other people, because this fact that one group produces both Zionism and anti-Semitism and the Nazi Party, and this group is also in control of the allied political class, right, that is waging war against this artificial political power in Germany. I mean, basically what you have is just almost a religious pageant. It's almost like these people are just doing things, you know, for, you know, basically religious or for just for their amusement. I think it was... World War One, they ended on the 11th of November at 11 p.m., you know, 333, right? So they put three 11s together in order to conclude World War One at that point. So, you know, the Masonic stamp as a symbol of their control over history, how they're creating these events is pretty clear cut. I mean, look, of course, you know, November 22nd, when Kennedy gets shot, another 33, you know, this comes up just over and over again, that the dates that we have as sort of existential events when you start looking at them, they're just completely artificial. And so what we need to do as just to try to have a real democracy is to get back of the creation of these dates and the creation of these false narratives so that we can see, you know, how we got led to the point where, you know, Europeans over the last 200 years have had, you know, you tell me, it's somewhere between 120 and 200 million people killed. I mean, this is a huge number, right? When you look at all these wars, and I don't think any of them are real. I don't think the Civil War, I don't think the Napoleonic Wars, I don't think the First World War or the Second World War, just to name four. None of these are, in fact, real historical.
If you want me to sum up global war or all war in a nutshell, somebody wanted more money and power, and he was able to convince a bunch of people to go and die for him to gain that.
Well, unfortunately, I agree with you. And sad, even more sad is the fact that it isn't just somebody, but it's some group. And so they're just very well organized. So this is, you know, this is an interesting moment, because now with the internet, the civilians, the, you know, the populace has a chance to circumvent the fake history. I mean, if you go to an American university, you learn about a potato famine. You learn about an insane German leader who just sprang up after out of the chaos of World War One, and who created an anti-Semitic Nazi party.
Yeah.
And then you learn about the heroic Winston Churchill, you know, we're going to battle them on the beaches and, you know, in the streets.
Well, this is right out of Orwell's 1984. He said that in the 30 years after, you know, the party in 1984, INGSOC took over everything. What they progressively did is they re-educated everybody as to what history was and who invented what and that kind of thing. And so people were getting to the point where they'd believe that the party did anything, you know, like it invented the airplane. Right. And that's exactly the same plan that's being played right now on all the people that are at these collective mind control organizations that we call education. And essentially, it's indoctrinating everybody to be part of this new global religion super state where facts don't matter anymore, morality doesn't matter anymore, and freedom doesn't matter anymore, unless you're part of one of those clubs. In which case, they matter quite a lot.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that, you know, if you look at sort of what we call the anti-discrimination laws in the United States and where they come from, really what you're looking at is sort of a conclusion of or a legal expression of the power of what's called cultural Marxism. And people, you know, it's funny, they don't know where the term comes from. It's very easy to understand. It's just Marxism, basically a radical egalitarianism where all sense of property and identity are evaporated in a culture, where as opposed to economics and, you know, political power, cultural Marxism is just the same idea except expressed into the bureaucracy.
Well, it's to actually simplify it even further, cultural Marxism. So it's a Marxist cult ideology. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Sure it does. Again, this is a perfect you know, phenomena for people to study, because again, it's sort of, you know, we don't have a good idea where these kind of moral forces originate, you know, like Zionism, like anti-Semitism, like the Nazis. I mean, we don't see this, we don't see the origin. With cultural Marxism, you can go all the way back to Marx. I mean, Marx's first work was on the family, it was on the origin of the family. It wasn't Das Kapital, or, you know, it basically was an attack on the family. It said that, you know, basically to have a better world, a workers' paradise, we didn't just need control over production. We needed basically to destroy the family, because the family was suggested as being basically representing a bourgeois influence, right?
So, yeah. In other words, the family told you who you are and where you come from and made you more individual and more difficult to control, because you had to differentiate your own identity with your siblings and your parents and that kind of thing as you grew up.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that it also linked together with other families, and then you had what was called ethnicity. And now ethnicity was extremely difficult for the oligarchs to control. Very impenetrable. A friend of mine, he was telling me a story. He grew up in Lake Erie, and he was in before basically cultural Marxism took over the United States or its legal system. You had a lot of ethnic communities. There were Poles and Irish and Germans and Italians, and they lived side by side, but there were these were ethnic groups. This was all brought about, was brought to an end deliberately after World War II. But he told me a story about, he was Irish, and he lived in Lake Erie, near Lake Erie. And one day in the 50s, I guess it was, yeah, late 50s, someone came into town selling pornography, dirty pictures. He said it was very quick, the response. The dads got together, got the individual, and beat him up. That was the end of the problem. And this is how an ethnic relationship can then, you know, have power and can protect its culture, right? That was, you know, I mean, that's a crude example. I hate to bring fisticuffs into such a dignified discussion.
You actually touched on an interesting point here, which I was thinking while I was taking a leak over the break, is that when the Dutch East India Company was going around invading lands, stealing resources, taking slaves, they found that sometimes those cultures rebelled against them and tried to kill them and stuff like that. So they went to the Queen and they say, look, Your Majesty, we're stealing, we're enslaving, we're destroying the world just like you asked. All that we need now is just some military protection, okay? So that if anybody actually tries to give us consequences for our actions and teach us what is not okay in their culture, we can just kill them and get away with it. Is that not entirely dissimilar from exactly what you're talking about with the ethnicity beating up the guy with the pornography? Somebody came in, tried to do something that was basically against your local culture, and you could do something about it because he wasn't supported by armed thugs. But what if he was?
Yeah, well, and also, what if your ethnicity had been deracinated? See, in the United States, we created the suburbs after World War II. This was an enormous social project.
Well, that's after the Seven Sisters Oil Companies bought up all the public transport and then shut it all down so that everybody had to buy petrol for their cars. But yes,
well, exactly right. And it was a well-structured program. But one of the key things they wanted to do was to end the European ethnic communities, in my opinion. When they moved from the areas that they'd been living for hundreds of years, in some cases, to these suburbs, that was the end of the ethnic connection. They became basically the great white middle class. And that culture really couldn't resist basically the influences that were going to come forward, like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, to use an expression, because you didn't have sort of the centrifugal cultural energy of an ethnicity. They were sitting ducks. But, you know, in the story I was relating, that culture was still intact and it could defend itself. But if you look at the suburbs today, I mean, people really don't have those kinds of connections. They're not really organized in any way. The individuals have been basically isolated, atomized.
Well, with fences, walls, curtains, and television and computers, we have been completely walled off from each other, right? And How do you identify, I'm just saying theoretically, how do you identify a culture within a community whereby each and every person is capable of defending each and every other person? And the answer is they all know each other in that community. You go down any street now in any town, or any city rather, and the chances that everybody knows everybody on that street are zero. Right? And not even small amount, but zero. Because we're that really walled off from each other.
See, they don't defend each other, and therefore they become vulnerable to basically any kind of attack by the government or by anyone, but particularly by clever government attacks against culture to further atomize. I mean, you know, like feminism, there are many good components to the concept, but as Gloria Steinem brought it to power in the United States, it was basically coming through the same group that ran World War II. I mean, she was a CIA agent. She was getting her, you know, if you look into her history, you can see that just completely malevolent. And the kind of feminism she was peddling was just a way to basically shatter the family even further. So the family was taken apart. You ended up with a single mom and what can be described as the pornographic male, right? So pornography became basically ubiquitous through the internet. I mean, I don't know what the statistic is in New Zealand, but in the United States, I've seen up to like 40-50% of the total internet traffic is pornographic.
Yeah, right? I wouldn't imagine it's any different.
Well, who knows? I mean, it's a sad story, but this is an attack because now you're basically just isolating people left and right, you know, because how can someone who grows up in the pornographic culture, who's had like 5,000 hours of pornography watching, I mean, what kind of romantic process can that individual go through to create a family?
Well, they've found women in particular are getting really, really affected by this because you get young males in particular who have zero sexual experience. You know, they've never touched or kissed a woman. They've never danced with her and that kind of thing, going immediately for sexual advances. And they come off as very, very creepy kind of thing. And it seems to me that this is going to be used to create what they call now full nest syndrome, which is kids going to university and then coming back home, because essentially you can't move out of home anymore unless you've got a partner. You know, you can't afford the rent anywhere that you go, even if it's one bedroom. So what's happening now is you're getting guys who are swearing off sex with women altogether. Right, they're all for the porn, but they don't want to have sex with women anymore because they've gotten rejected because the image of a woman and how she acts, what her feelings are like in a porn film is drastically different from reality, and they've chosen to ignore reality. And as Ayn Rand said, you can ignore reality, but you cannot ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
Yeah. She was one creepy broad, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah. And very racist, too. But
yeah,
as I say, even a desert of lies may yield a grain of truth.
Indeed. But, you know, so this is, you know, post-World War II, you start having the cultures, ethnic cultures were atomized, the families were atomized, and you could start to basically work on individuals. And that's really where we're at now. I mean, we have with Facebook and Google, we have more information, you know, coming to us through computers than ever before, obviously. But we have also created basically the alt media. And this is the one hope, is that the civilian can use this enormous power, the power of the internet, to communicate between ourselves and to express our concerns and to exchange information. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, as we have our discussion, that people will be inspired, perhaps too strong a word, but would just want to do more research into this area.
That is technically inspiration, though. It's like a spring of water. It always comes from within. It just takes somebody taking the well head off so that you can spring out, you know. And that's essentially what it is. You know, you interview, you know, 1,000 people, and each of them tell you the same story. Oh, I was an ordinary guy, and I'd worked on this really, really hard, and now I've discovered something that's really, really different, and I need to tell a lot of people about it so that all the bad things that could potentially happen if they remain ignorant of it don't happen, right? And I have a moral obligation. If you hear that story 1,000 times from 1,000 different people for 1,000 different reasons, it's going to change who you are and the way you look at the world, and more specifically the way you look at yourself, and realize that, yeah, actually on the inside we do kind of function the same, so long as we don't turn into psychopaths without a conscience. And then because if we do that, we can't turn back.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, couldn't agree more. What I'm looking for are just analytic structures that are so strong that they will make just the average person have pause as far as themselves. In other words, our biggest problem is that we've been programmed, coded by the oligarchs, the secret society. They control the media. I mean, if you look at CBS in the United States, William Paley, Freemason, Jewish guy, OSS, he sets up CBS as a television network, and you get the all-seeing eye as the symbol, right? So this is not exactly camouflage, right? It's just right in your face. So this is what we've had to put up with in terms of our media, right? The media has been basically a conduit that the oligarchs used to control us. But it's also the historical narration. It's how they describe World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War. All of the, I mean, of course, if you look at the wars in the Middle East, the never-ending wars there, you know, they have 9-1-1 as the, you know, the cover story to explain how we get into this. But the good news is that more and more people are doubting this. And so what I'm looking for are just structures that will give people pause, that will create a little bit of space between just automatic flow of consciousness, of accepting all of your memory about history and what you have as an attitude regarding it, a little bit of a pause so that there can be some thinking, some space, some awareness, some recollection of other possibility. And so to do that, I mean, like, look at how many people who have had that moment vis-a-vis 9-1-1. You know, they look at the symmetrical collapse of Building 7 or the Twin Towers, and they go, wait a second, that doesn't look real. The pause occurred.
It just hit me now.
Yeah.
Somebody who understands special effects and understands controlled demolition, seeing that on television for the first time, and what the media is telling them and that kind of thing, they must have all collectively, the whole world over, just gone into shock. Because they knew what they were looking at, and they knew that what they were being told was a lie, and they must have it must have traumatized. I mean, 9/11 traumatized the whole world, right, through the media. But those people who actually knew what they were looking at, they were among the first to really feel the real shock. Is not only is boom, that's happening, oh my God, that's so shocking, but we did it to ourselves, that realization that your own government does it. I mean, what's the leading cause of death in the 20th century? As far as I know, on the statistics, it's democide. What's democide? It's when you get fucking exterminated by your democratically elected officials.
Yeah. Well, they're not, they don't care too much about reducing the population of civilians. I mean, if they were organizing the Irish genocide, the idea of, like, you know, millions of people being reduced is not a problem for these guys. They think broad strokes, and they just have an absolute absence of any kind of human empathy for certain groups. And so we need to understand that, because that will create hopefully the energy and desperation to fight back effectively.
Well, you've touched on something there that's actually also important to raise, is that people with a conscience don't understand that there are people who don't think like them, right? Yeah. In general, until you've met and dealt with and been a victim of somebody who you can see and know doesn't have a conscience. The world won't make sense to you. But if you realize that it's run by crazy people without a conscience, have a look at the media and anything that's going on anywhere, you're like, that makes total sense now.
Right. Well, you know, I was looking at a video of Bush during 9-1-1 when he's at a school, and the kids are reading, you know, a book. And the two books
My Pet Goat.
My Pet Goat, which, of course, you know, the idea of the sacrifice. Yeah. And then the story that the teacher was training the kids, that had three words at one point: plane hit steel. Now, you know, knowing that Bush was involved, obviously, with 9-1-1, and then you look at these facts in that context, you can see the cold-bloodedness, the relish of human sacrifice. That's really the thing that the population has to understand, is that you're not dealing with, you know, engineers. You're not dealing with people that are trying to basically, well, we need to, like, you know, reduce population because there's global warming. I mean, the rationale is the pleasure in slaughter, right? This is certainly what can be seen if you understand Bush was involved with it during in that moment. And there's just dozens and dozens of other examples. And I'll give you the one that really came to up recently is that, you know, in the WikiLeaks that led to the whole Pizzagate business, you had one of them contain a request of Podesta for a Thelema favor, right? Thelema favor. And the favor was to see Barack Obama. So this wasn't just an ordinary kind of, you know, give me a $5 bill. It was, I want to see the president. I have someone I want to introduce to Obama. Can you arrange it? And they requested it as a Thelema favor. Now, Thelema is not a term that ordinary people would understand the meaning of. I mean, it is Aleister Crowley's religion. He named his religion the Thelema. You see, this is what the word means. So this person used the term without any kind of explanatory context. So this person who sent Podesta the email knew that Podesta would not only understand the term, but that it was important enough that this could be the reason why he would basically arrange someone to be able to have access to the president of the United States. But when you look at Crowley's, you know, his description, and you get into the, you know, spirit cooking and other rituals that he's describing, I mean, you know, you talked earlier about the group are satanic. Well, yes, they are. There's absolutely no doubt. You couldn't use the term Thelema with Podesta without any kind of context, provided if you weren't absolutely sure that he not only would understand it, but that he would see it in a positive light. And that means that he is a satanic individual. I
mean, it seems not as a positive light. It seems an obligatory light.
Obligatory, exactly. Powerful. So the thing is that we have a real problem in that the political class has been taken over by a group which can well be described as Satanists. And so I would think that the general population needs to find a little bit of energy to be able to start doing more research and to try to help more people come to the light. We need an illumination of our own groups. They have their illumination and all of the rituals that they have and the secret knowledge that they share. We need to basically steel ourselves in similar ways, to organize ourselves and to not allow people that we love and know to simply wander in the darkness. Mm-hmm. We really have to start taking the affirmative steps, the bold steps, to just say, you know, I'm just tired of these banal conversations. There's something really serious in this world, really grim, that we need to discuss, we need to organize about. We can't just waste time anymore with, you know, social organizations that go nowhere, with dinners overlooking Auckland Harbor. I was recently in Auckland, and I was amazed at how built up it had become, and had a very intense conversation with someone looking out over Auckland Harbor. That person is a very, very good researcher, and it wasn't, you know, the kind of conversation I'm describing, but it was just the opposite, in fact. But in any case, sorry to segue to that. But the fact is we really have to start finding the courage inside ourselves to interrupt conversation. We can't accept any longer. There is too much clear-cut evidence that we are in the process of being genocided. And there is too much evidence to show that the government, as we know it, is basically hiding its true nature from us, that we can just sit back and have pleasant conversations, you know, make time with one another. We have to start focusing ourselves. We have to start accepting, you know, whatever the cost is, social ostracization from some groups, pissing off people, having awkward moments. It doesn't matter. What difference does it make? You see, we are really at the, you know, when you get to the point of collapse that we are coming to with all of the toxicity and the food and the environment and in the culture, this is the time to act right now. We don't have time to waste.
Yeah. I think what separates the rest of society from the secret societies is obviously the secrecy. So I was just wondering if there was forms of initiation, of rites that you actually had to ascend to brotherhood, etc., in an open societal manner. Like if there was a publicly organized society that's just saying, hey, bro, you know, you've got to stick up for yourself. You've got to stick up for those who can't defend themselves. You've got to do this, that, and the other, and what have you. But what if that society was not an official one, right? Well, what if it was just a general rule? You know, somebody like signed up to it and just said, yeah, absolutely, I'll obey those principles. How could you get that going, right? It'd be interesting to see a long-running open conspiracy against the long-running secret conspiracy. That's number one. And number two is understanding psychopaths is pretty much like understanding the brain. You've got three levels to your brain. One does your analytical thinking, one does your emotional thinking, and one does your fight or flight thinking. Which two parts of the brain do you think are inactive on brain scans of psychopaths? The analytical thinking and the emotional thinking. Now, where do you get your pleasure, ladies and gentlemen? Your dopamine. All right, your oxytocin. This stuff you get through being in extreme situations, and also adrenaline. Extreme situations, sex, and drugs, and also feeling powerful. That's what operates all those portions of the brain, and they're all located in the psychopathic part of the brain, the reptilian cortex that governs your fight or flight. All of those things are activated. So if you've got somebody who can only think with that part of the brain, what are they going to turn into? They're going to be a sex-mongering, murdering maniac, because the only way that they can ever feel something, anything, is if they're doing one of these things. Making themselves more powerful, fucking something, or putting something into their body that physically releases those chemicals. That's all they know how to do. Conscience doesn't even come into it, because you feel nothing.
Indeed, and you can be trained into becoming a psychopath. This is really the sad fact, is that if you look at the military training of elite soldiers, their psychology is broken down in boot camp and these training regiments. They lose their sense of identity. They will end up obeying any order that's given to them. They don't have a moral perspective. This is done by training. I think that to some extent, the secret society operates in this way. They will systematically break down the individual, and particularly since I think that a great many of them are basically young men who are children when they begin the process to become a member of the society. So when you get to someone like George Bush with the smirk on his face, right, talking about 911, I mean, here's in just looking at, you know, George Bush Jr. with the press conferences about 911 with this kind of weird smirk, he's experiencing a kind of emotional pleasure, right? In the lie, in the fooling of people, but even in the violence, right, that he was part of. And so even though this is unfortunately a very small example and small body count relative to all of the Mideast mortality, right, that this event sprang forward from, I mean, okay, came out of, this just shows what we're dealing with. And it's just, again, it's just, you know, normal people, the normies, as we call them.
Muggles.
The muggles, you know, they have a kind of intimidation or a timidness where they may not be completely okay with the normal explanation of 911. You know, if they have an engineering background or if they've seen the collapse, they may want to just discuss the idea of, well, could this have been controlled demolition? But this intimidation, this social intimidation, keeps them from taking that step. So this is where, you know, this is the role of those who are more confident, more aggressive comes. This is where, you know, heroic individuals like yourself, for example, will come into play, because they're not afraid. They don't mind taking the heat. They will come. And so that's why I'm saying, look, if there's ever a moment when you can interject into a conversation, the facts of the secret society and of how they're manipulating our culture, our history, the media. Do it. Don't waste an opportunity. There's no time to waste here. We've got to just do it time and time and time and time again. And, you know, I'll tell you just as a personal example, at first you're ostracized, don't get invited to many parties. This was me, you know, like
parties?
10 years.
What?
Yeah, what's that? I'm telling you, I'm getting more into vogue. I've noticed that even though not necessarily everyone agrees to me, people now are starting to want to talk about it. And I think this is directly related to the power of the alt media. I mean, I know this is a small sample size, my little life, but nevertheless, it's so clear to me that I do think it can be discussed as an event. I think that people are getting more and more comfortable talking about the government as a secret society, a government that is something that hides the reality from the people. More than 50% of the people in the latest poll don't buy the government's version of reality of 911. Mm-hmm. So that was very heartening to me. And this means that, you know, as that number gets greater and greater, then we can start just opening up more and more conversational avenues so that everyone starts feeling comfortable. And so this is why, you know, I wanted to get back to the idea of like, how do we link up and join? Well, look at the network of people that support you. I mean, that's like a congregation. That is something that could be put into motion with another group. You know, there's so much kind of self-destruction in the alt media. People spring up and they accuse other people, you know, of like being agents or of being disinfo agents. You know, this happens just time and time again.
Well, it's
you
because
know?
They're traumatized narcissists who basically they don't have a whole lot of self-worth and self-value yet. They haven't learned who they really are and where they really come from. And so when people oppose them or accuse them of something or whatever, they go immediately to the attack. Because when they were raised, they weren't loved or given proper enough attention. And so they always felt they had to defend themselves aggressively in order to get things done.
Right. You can see that in some of them. But, you know, there's going to be shills. The government will obviously not want the alt media to have power. And there obviously will be people who are fragile mentally, emotionally, because let's face it, you know, the alt media does attract such individuals. But this is irrelevant. We have to develop a strategy beyond those facts. So the question is how can organizations that do exist, congregations that do exist, support one another, support mutual growth, support a connection, have systems in place to defend one another? Because, you know,
say that, because you just described my organizational model for guerrilla media, where you've got a central website with all these independent people that have their own websites, and basically it's just a feed of all of their material constantly, and there's little donate buttons for each individual contributor to the website, so that they don't actually have to do anything. They just do their stuff, and it automatically gets published onto the centralized website, which automatically asks for people to go and support that person. So that way you have a central authority that has no authority, who doesn't take a cut and allows for the wide-ranging support of a number of individuals. Now, ironically enough, that idea was stolen from me by an FBI agent. informant, you know, and tried to make it his own. And then because he didn't understand the real concept of it, is that in order to run something like that, you've got to have a conscience and you've got to care more about somebody else than you do yourself to a large degree. You've got to care more about the purpose of tomorrow than about your purposes today. And he didn't understand that, and that's why he failed, because he was always undercutting people, taking all the money for himself, and lying about what's going to happen and where the money's going to come from, that kind of thing. So you can see an organizational model easily being able to get co-opted and get destroyed. And that's another important point, is that all positive movements, this elite's been around for quite some time, all positive movements that have risen to destroy them have thus far gotten infiltrated and dissolved.
Right. And it's going to happen in the alt media. We absolutely have to develop a strategy for growth and information distribution that anticipates crazies and shills. There will be both.
And this was why in the guerrilla media concept, we use the concept of the phalanx, which is you have a big shield that protects your vital organs. You know, that's you protecting yourself. But your job actually is, as the organization, is to protect the person next to you with your shield. So if somebody within the organization gets attacked, lies being told about them, everybody comes together to protect them. And to reassure everybody that, no, actually, this person's on the frickin' level, and they all work together to expose whoever's trying to attack them. Or they have this thing called the Leadership Council, where kind of like the Jedi Council, where you have people who have long track records of self-sacrifice for the good of others who aren't really getting paid or anything like that. But if in some case somebody who is a contributor to the website, a member of the alternative media, their authenticity gets called into question and evidence actually needs to be amassed and a discussion really needs to be had as to whether or not this person is an actual real government agent or shill. And then we can X them out of the organization and then use a collective effort to, again, expose who that person really is and make it definitive. So this way you have an organization that doesn't have the corruptibility, has a universal appeal, also has the capability of defending itself from inside attacks, as well as defending each of its members, no matter who they are or where they are, from any kind of a media type attack. And that was the organizational model that had three intersecting rings that protect each other and look after each other, kind of like how they envisioned automated factories would be in the future, where one machine does the job, one machine repairs that one if it breaks down, and there's another machine behind it that can repair both of them if either of them break down. So you will have an infinite cycle of protection and exposure to the truth.
A great idea, really great concept. Love to see this implemented. And from the internet perspective, then have it move out into the real world even. I wanted to clarify one thing. I think you were just making a joke about me being an ex-Jesuit priest. I wish I could claim the title. I'm not a big fan of the Jesuits. I think the organization is compromised. But unfortunately, at the time of my life when I would have been in the seminary, Vinny, this was a dark era, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'm afraid I found another path during the 60s, and it took me a while kind of to get my bearing. But the last thing in the world I would have been doing would have been attending a seminary. It's funny. I mean, I'm sure you have this experience too, but there are so many kind of rumors that as I've gotten sort of, you know, a small place in the alt media, to whatever degree I have people that, you know, kind of like pay attention to what I'm saying, the attacks on me are basically geometric. You know, in other words, if you look at sort of like gang stalking and rumors being spread and this and that, I would just, you know, advocate the process that you have described, that, you know, we should have basically a way where people can be vetted whenever there is, because, you know, if we bog down in it, I mean, I typically don't even respond. I just think it's sort of silly, but it does raise the larger question of how do we move forward, you know, as an organization, how does the alt media replace the legacy media? How does the free media could replace a controlled media so that we can really educate the people as to what is reality? Well, you know, we need to basically make sure that, you know, when there is someone who basically makes such a charge, that the process that you described, where there would be basically, you know, information would simply become public. Once it is public, then sunshine, the collective minds of all of the group, the people involved in those, the three circles that you described, they can simply weigh in and they can say, okay, this is a bogus claim or this is real. And then they could put out their findings, and then that would be something that the public could then have so that we wouldn't become bogged down, because we can't let just the ability to accuse someone, right? We can't let that be something that can prevent people from having impact in the alt media. what we really want is people who have ideas that can create more solid analytic structures that will make people wake up. You know, that's what we need. You know, a lot of people criticize Alex Jones as being like a disinfo show. I know I hurl the charge at him, and I would have different kinds of evidence, I think, than most people would. But I also think, even as a limited hangout, he's been very valuable. A lot of people have become open to these ideas through people like this and other people in the media. So, you know, we have what's called the limited hangout. I don't think that, you know, someone needs to be completely, you know, sort of ivory pure as far as their background. There's going to be all kinds of problems. The real question, Vinny, is the information and the data, right, and the analysis that someone's giving, is there value? Is there something we can use here that you know, can keep the spreading of the alt media? I'm telling you, Vinny, if we have another 10 years, we will be able to turn things around. We just have to make sure that the alt media is not destroyed, because as it's moving forward now, I mean, it's even affecting cocktail parties here in California, whereas 15 years ago, none of these subjects would have been even possible to discuss. I mean, it is affecting consciousness. And because we have the truth on our side and facts on our side, well, that tends to basically connect with people's minds and reasoning. And so the sophistry of the controlled media is helpless against people who are sincere and who are really trying to present the truth. So,
which is why they omit them from the media.
Yeah, indeed. So this is the time for, you know, heroic action. This is the time when people in the alt media need to be self-sacrificing and need to do everything we can over the next decade to just keep the fire growing, because we are starting to get into the minds of the citizenry. And believe me, there is a kind of a tipping point, and it's hard really to know where it is, but I would say something like between 20, maybe 40%. If you get 40% of the population that knows the truth about something like 911 and is willing to actually act out on this truth, within 1 week, the existing political structure will fall, because it won't be able to keep itself intact.
I think it's significantly smaller than that, and it's based upon the percentage of active individuals within a cause. The vast majority of revolutions throughout history have had between 3 and 5% of the population on tap, and interestingly enough, approximately 6% of a zebra herd, if 6% of them become aware that there's a lion stalking in the grass, instantaneously the rest of the herd becomes aware that there's a lion in the grass. Now, on top of that, you've got 100th monkey syndrome, whereby a scientist would be studying a group of monkeys on one island off the coast of Japan, and they'd have these specific tools that they would use to get ants out of a hive, and they were the only monkeys around that did that. But he rationalized that as soon as 100 of them had learned this one particular technique, he then traveled to another island and found that these other monkeys were using that exact same technique. So there's a... what we call that tipping point, I think it's a psychic thing. I'm not sure if it's like something that can be physically measured or whatever, because there's lots of radio waves going through the air. The telescope was invented by 7 people on the same night on opposite ends of the earth that had never met. There's weird shit that happens, man. And I feel that there will be one of those miraculous circumstances and suddenly everything will be different. Right, but you won't be able to see it coming is the problem, so, which is why I've turned off so much alternative media because of their predictions, right? Their predictions never panning out. Oh, they're going to do martial law here. Oh, they're going to release a bioweapon. Oh, you're going to be scared of this. Oh, you're going to be scared of that. And it's just like, it's pissing me off because it's something that hasn't happened yet. But I've really, really turned up the alternative media that have said, this has happened in the past because of this, that, and that, who, what, when, where, how, and why. And that way you get a full 360 holistic analysis of a subject. That's knowledge. That's truth. And if 5% of the population had that level of knowledge and truth behind them and were motivated to go out on a daily basis, live their life in such a way where they would try to be making the world a better place each day, better than it was yesterday. Yeah, it caused that ripple effect, I think.
Absolutely. And like you say, there's going to be, in hindsight, no one will see it coming. You know, and no one will go like, it's this date, it's that date. You know, it will just be, in hindsight, we will recognize that, wait a second, that was what the moment was. All we can do now is just to continue to spread the truth as fast and as hard as we can. That's what we have to do. And we'll see where the tipping point is, but we can't predict it. And the where it is in the future is irrelevant. We just have to work as hard as we can today, you know, to get it done. And so, you know, you've done a great job, Vinny. I mean, your show has really been very valuable. I really like it. It's one of my favorite shows to watch. And I think that the future is bright. You know, I think, like you're saying, all the doomsdayers, you know, and this is going to happen and that's going to happen. No one knows when these things will occur. We don't know really the strength of the secret society, where their technology really is, or what kind of issues they have inside of the group, if any. We don't know. Who knows this? Who cares? Yeah. What we have now is our freedom, our minds. Let's go into our future.
Yeah, let's make the best of it, ladies and gentlemen. The brain has an on and off switch. Turn your fucking brains on, all right? Now, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for supporting the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and I want to thank you as well, Joe, for joining us today. I just want your website. Just say your website for those who are on there.
Caesarsmessiah.com.
Caesarsmessiah.com. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Go and support the Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again next time.